John Fain with you, with Jill Singer, my co-host, through till 12 on The Conversation Hour. Our first guest was Philip Adams from Radio National. And our next guest now is Professor at the University of Toronto, Thomas Homer Dixon. He specialises in peace and conflict studies, and his book, The Upside of Down, has become a bestseller around the world. He's one of the key speakers at the Melbourne Writers' Festival that's on this weekend. And Thomas, welcome to Melbourne.
It's terrific to be here.
The central kind of nutshell of your book is that we might be like Rome on the brink of collapse, with Western civilization at a bit of a tipping point at the moment. Why do you think that?
I think we are in a time of potentially great danger. There are a number of stresses that we're encountering right at the moment that we don't really see so much on the surface of our daily affairs. Environmental stress, economic stress, widening gaps between rich and poor people, energy stress. We're about to go through a major transition from a petroleum age to a post-petroleum age. And, of course, climate change, which has received much more attention, especially in Australia.
Can you explain synchronous failure?
If things were to go really badly, and I don't think this is necessarily destined to happen, is going to happen, but if things were to go really badly, I could see that because we're so connected together on the planet now, we're so wired together, globalization has connected economies together, that if there were a serious failure of an economic and political system in one part of the world, that it could cause a kind of cascading failure elsewhere.
Domino effect.
A bit like a domino effect. And that's what I call a synchronous failure.
The reason for this, the way you examine it, is you look at the world as a complex system. So you look at systems theory and how things are connected, and that looks at the increasing risks that are attached with the links here that are going on. So basically what you're looking at as a solution is to basically decrease the complexity of a system. Is that right?
In some ways, you're exactly right that a lot of the story is about connectivity and different kinds of connectivity. I mean, we're seeing in the world right now with the subprime crisis in North America and the liquidity crunch that's developed around the world and has affected some banks in Australia, that there's a real downside sometimes to everybody being tightly coupled together.
But there's an answer. There's a simple answer to all your woes and troubles. Relax, gang. Get Bush a third term. With George Bush in the White House, climate change ceases to exist, doesn't it?
You just deny it away.
Just deny it away. And democracy blossoms. Wherever he looks, there's a blossoming.
Well, we needed a second term, I think, to thoroughly discredit this particular Republican formation. But a third term might actually be the death knell for American power and American authority in the world. And I think that would be a bad thing.
So do I.
Well, he's not allowed to have a third term.
No,
but that particular
group, we know that
that particular group of conservatives could have a third term in the United States,
and that would be
very bad news. That kind of cultural approach to governing that he represents.
Well, it still has its devotees. There's no doubt about it. And who's to say there might be some aspects of economic policy and the like. I mean, clearly, Iraq's been a failure. Climate change has been a failure. But his predecessor was not so flash at running an economy either, was he?
Well, I don't know. You look back at the Clinton years and you think, I mean, Clinton left the United States in a fiscal surplus, one of the healthiest economies that it ever had. And George Bush has run the country deeply into the red.
Principally because of the billions and billions and billions spent on the war in Iraq.
Trillions, thank you. Let's get our figures right.
And on Iraq, but also just, the conservatives. The conservatives who are angry with Bush in the United States are quite right when they say that he's actually been very irresponsible financially. He's brought in, for instance, a drug policy, which is extremely expensive and doesn't really help people very much. And in many ways, he's been just as profligate as many of the worst Democrats.
I like this bloke. Had him on the wireless. not in person like you have him today.
I know.
We had a lovely chat. He made us all incredibly depressed.
Yeah. Adrian, can I take you back?
That's why you like
him. That's why we like you. Late at night, serious depression. I think
it helps put you to sleep. Okay.
Can I take you back to complex systems? Because in a way, if we're going to look at complex systems and the risks of and manage the risks of things going wrong, which is what you're after, to make us a more resilient society.
That's right.
Where we can manage risk better, the more complex the system, really, you're going to have higher probabilities or of things going wrong and also of being able to predict what's going to go wrong, aren't you?
Yes and no. I have an extended argument about the dangers of complexity and the dangers of connectivity, but really in the end, I think you have to pick and choose. It's not all one or all the other. I don't think we should simplify wholesale across the board. So for instance, when it comes to something like climate change, we're going to have to start putting large quantities of carbon dioxide underground globally.
Sequestration,
billions of tons of carbon dioxide underground. That's not a simple operation. It's going to require complex financing, complex technologies. It's going to require complex regimes of carbon trading around the world. And it's something we desperately need. On the other hand, when it comes to, for instance, our energy consumption locally in our communities, reducing our carbon footprint. In many ways, that is about simplifying things. It's about perhaps having less materially intensive lives, less consumerist lives, and that can be a good thing. So again, I think some kinds of complexity are going to be valuable and important, and other kinds we have to relinquish.
So you're talking about bringing back production to generation of power to a more regional
and local.
Local level.
That's right.
Because there are dangers that you have seen in Canada. If you have the power all on a grid, the grid goes down,
everybody suffers. And everybody suffers. Of the stories I have in the book is about the great 2003 blackout in northeastern North America, where, you know, you had a significant power cable in Ohio touch some branches and short out a section of the system.
Cut the trees down. For heaven's sake, trees
you have such
put
simple
us all
answers.
At great risk.
If only we'd known how dangerous they were.
And the result was you had 30 million people out of power. And that, for me, is a metaphor.
And we
for,
can't cope with it. When something like that happens, the computers are down, the TVs.
Therefore, trees are a good thing. Did
you just switch your position on this?
Well, I like switching positions.
But the remarkable thing about that blackout is how useless we all were. And how enormously dependent we've become on everyday electrical devices. So people had no money.
They couldn't get it out of the ATM.
They couldn't get it out of the ATMs. The Visa machines didn't work. The debit machines didn't work. Things like hotel door rooms couldn't be opened. Mm. Garage doors couldn't be opened. And people retreated to the very basic things you do to take care of yourself, including walking out of the city by the tens of thousands.
The solution to that will be said to be more technology, not less.
Well, not you look at India, and of course it has a lot of problems in energy.
I'm trying to look at India.
Energy.
Get India up on Google Earth. Yeah, yeah.
But it's interesting. I've been there when the whole grid goes out in the north of India.
And everybody has terrible generators.
Everyone's got a generator. Right.
It's right. Very rare that the grid goes in.
But here's
an example. Miraculous when it works, but everyone's got a generator.
Here's an example of a kind of technological fix to a problem. You probably remember that a number of years ago there was a major earthquake in India, and many houses were demolished, especially ones that were built out of local materials, mud and bricks that weren't able to withstand that kind of shock. But there are new kinds of technologies that are being developed that are still using local materials, mud, that make for much stronger houses. And it's relatively simple. It's local construction, and yet it's still much more resilient than the stuff that they had before.
Aren't Canadians good value? You're always better off with a Canadian in the studio.
Not all of them. Look, it helps sell books to create a sense of impending catastrophe, but is it necessarily true? Every generation have had their touchstone issues. Every generation have had the crisis that could be the one. I mean, our parents' generation, obviously World War II and the standoff over the Cold War and missiles, mutual destruction.
Pretty
all
big crises.
Sort of. Yeah, yeah, and you can keep on going back. And I reckon probably if you go back 10 generations and 20 generations, although I don't know enough about what my ancestors were doing, but I'll bet they had issues, whether it was the plague
not
or something.
Not quite at the scale of this.
Cool.
I brought dear old James Lovelock out to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. And in his more optimistic moments, he says, in the next 40, 50 years, billions of us will die, billions. And we may have a few breeding pair of human beings left over who can start again in a melted Arctic. That is without precedent. It's just a bit bigger.
Doesn't are there too right, many though. People on Earth, Adrian?
I think that there are
many Republicans.
I think we would be much better off if we had, instead of 6.2 heading towards 9 billion people, if we had 3 billion people.
Which 3 billion?
Now, it's possible we'll get to 3 billion in a relatively peaceful way because population will start to decline later this century just because of normal fertility transitions.
Would it decline in the Bush family? That's the thing I need to...
John, I want to get back to your point about the...
Yeah, please, because he's going to he's going to take me off into territory where maybe...
It's like having Spike Milligan in the studio or something, isn't it?
Late Night Live, you might get away with this sort of stuff. This is local radio here.
I'm sure the audience is finding it entertaining. Yeah. But I think you're right that every generation thinks that it's on the cusp of chaos. Yeah. And so I spend a fair amount of time in the book saying, well, really, is this period of time different? Is there something new happening? And I think Philip was basically correct that the scale of what we're doing on the planet right now, the perturbations of, for instance, the planet's climate, or something that we've never really seen before. I think we are in an unprecedented period, and I think the stakes are very high. Now, the reason the book is called The Upside of Down is because I also think that often it's in times of crisis that people are most creative and that there's the greatest opportunity for making real change. So we shouldn't go into this period with a sense of fear and trepidation. Instead, we should be thinking about how we're going to change things for the better in the future in a time that's going to be
very
volatile.
It's going to be hard to turn around, though, because when we look at what's happened.
Here's what's happened. In the last 12 months, it has turned around. Al Gore, first of all, with his movie and the book, but then when Rupert Murdoch decided that there was an issue and you give the benefit of the doubt to the planet, surely that was a crucial moment even for conservatives.
And quite a lot of people in Rupert's empire don't take him seriously on this issue. If you look across the News Limited book, there are still deniers everywhere.
Oh, well, that's because they're a broad church. But there was a clear change from a guy who is unparalleled in his
influence. In reality, what has happened? And what I'm wondering about, though, too...
Sorry, but all the same, nobody would have thought in Canada that you would get climate change right at the top of the agenda in the polls 2 years ago, and yet that's happened in the last year to 18 months. And I think Australia is good evidence for the point I'm going to make, that what really matters is people seeing stuff happening outside their windows. The practical evidence that people are seeing of climate change, that they've lived long enough to realize that within a 10 or 20 year period, things are already really different.
Come and live on our place. We've had the most intractable drought for the last 9 years.
My wife's
formed a climate change political party.
And Australia, because of your experience with drought, is in some sense leading the way in a lot of respects in the popular discussion of this issue. Maybe not at the level of government, but certainly the public seems to be much more aware of it. I mean, I arrived in Australia the first time I've been here. I arrived in Sydney and I was waiting in a line in the airport with Virgin Blue to check my bags. And without prompting somebody, within 2 minutes, I was in a conversation with somebody in my line about climate change. And they were informed.
Are they just talking about the weather or talking about climate change?
No, it was climate change, about the drought.
I've just had friends over from England and they came home and they said, "What's going on out here? Half your backyard is tanks now." You know, and I said, "Well, it's all changed. We need this. Otherwise, I won't be able to have a garden."
Now, that's a good example of resilience. Mm. People taking, and again, a relatively simple technology, taking steps in their own households to make themselves more resilient to the vagaries of the environment, to drought in the future. That's a good thing.
And what was regarded as the kind of the wacko Greens barely a decade ago is suddenly mainstream. So what impact does that have on the national psyche here in Australia? Well, it's a difficult one for you, but in Western communities right around the world.
We will know that this issue is being taken very seriously by policy elites when we have a carbon market and we have a price on carbon in the neighborhood of $30 a ton. Now, once that happens, you will change the international market dramatically, international economy dramatically, and you'll find entrepreneurs coming out from all over the place to solve the problem of getting carbon out of the atmosphere.
Not because they want to save the environment.
No, because they want to make
money
a buck
out of it.
That's right. Yeah.
Our government says that we are moving towards a market for carbon, but at the same time refuses to put a cap on emissions.
Yeah, you have to do this in conjunction with a cap and trade system.
You've got to.
Yeah.
I don't see how it can work without it.
And cap and trade actually is an idea that the public can understand quite quickly if they don't already. I think lots of members of our chattering classes in our societies basically get the idea of cap and trade.
Do you think that Al, if he can lose a few stone, might come back into the fray, might be a late entrant?
Don't think he will.
Al being Al Gore.
I think the evidence that he's considering it would be that he starts to lose weight, and I don't see any evidence.
Serious point, yeah.
He said something very interesting in an interview not long ago, because of course he gets asked this question all the time, and he said, actually, I've come to the conclusion that I'm not a terrifically good politician. He said, I can't triangulate. I can't compromise. I speak with passion about particular issues that may cost me politically.
Well, he speaks with passion on this issue. His trouble, I think, was he didn't do it before. Speak with passion on anything.
But so many of them do when they're out of politics. Look at so many politicians when they're out of the deal-making that you've just talked about.
Or ex-diplomats, yeah, we often talk to, suddenly have a new lease of life and honesty.
Speaking of which, Hans Blix and Gareth Evans on The Conversation Hour next Monday, both here in the studio together. Thank you for that, Philip.
I think Al Gore is having vastly more influence now than he would as president in terms of the one issue that he believes in most. He has. There have been probably three or four things that have really put climate change on the agenda.
I haven't heard any of the Republican candidates talking about it.
McCain does.
He's so out of the race now.
He has been co-sponsoring a bill in front of Congress, the Senate, for a number of years on climate change to try to bring forward climate
change.
Good on
him. But mostly you hear from the Republicans an auction on Guantanamo, how to make it bigger, how to fit more prisoners in. And even Barack Obama and Hillary talk about climate change in code. Mm-hmm. But they're terribly, terribly cautious not to make it a big issue.
I think that, though, when the administration changes, fairly quickly we'll see a sea change in policy on climate change, even if it were Republican. Now, the interesting thing about Republicans is there might be a Nixon goes to China phenomena here, so that if Giuliani gets in, for example.
Oh, yeah. He'll cut all those ideas adrift, won't he?
Well, it's interesting. There are very, very few, even Republicans, who are as obtuse and unwilling to accept factual scientific information and data as this current administration. It's going to be difficult for these still very smart men on the Republican side to simply ignore what the science is saying.
We were talking before about the constitutional limitation on a third term for George, praise the Lord. But there's another constitutional limitation, which means the best Republican contender cannot run, and that's the ban on people born outside the country, which rules Schwarzenegger out. Schwarzenegger's the best of the lot.
Isn't that a surprise, though? I was shocked to see the way he performed.
And the interesting thing about Schwarzenegger, first of all, it's very handy in politics to have low expectations of you.
Yes.
And people weren't expecting very much. And he has done vastly better than a lot of Democrats and liberals thought he would.
Better than that other wrestler. What was his name?
Jesse Ventura.
Jesse Ventura,
that's
yes.
That's right.
I thought you were talking about Johnny Weissmuller from
Mario Milano.
The other thing very interesting about Schwarzenegger, and it demonstrates something more a general point, I think, is that he lost a referendum on a number of propositions he'd put forward, and he lost wholesale, and it was a huge defeat. And this really is a test of somebody's mettle. He picked himself up. He said, okay, I realize that this is a message from the California people. I'm going to move to the center. Mm. And he brought in as his top staffer, a leading Democrat, and he's spent the time since then building a centrist set of policies and centrist political space in California, and the Californians love him for it. He's a smart man.
Tell us a bit about Canadian politics. We've focused so much on your next-door neighbour. What's happening there?
Well, we have a minority government, conservatives, and we've had a difficult time on the liberal side because we've gone through a recent liberal campaign and selection of a new leader.
What about the
Stéphane
scandal?
Dion.
Don't forget the scandal.
The scandal?
Yeah, we've had some wonderful scandals in Canadian politics. And
the advertising scandal in Quebec, and that did enormous damage to the Liberal Party, and that's really why the Liberal Party was tossed out of power. Now, the Liberals have been regarded for a long time, and we should say the Liberals in Canada are center left, not the same as the Liberals in Australia.
Yeah, small L Liberals, yeah.
Small L Liberals, and they've been regarded as sort of the party of the permanent government in Canada for a long time. I don't know if...
So they're like our Liberals.
If that's the case. I'm not so familiar with Australian politics that I would know. I think Canadian politics in many ways right now is being defined by a struggle over the kind of economy we're going to have. Mm. And that's the struggle between Ontario and Alberta. And Alberta is, of course, resurgent with just staggering energy wealth, in particular from the development of tar sands. Its conventional oil production has been declining, but its tar sands production has been going up.
It's not Johnny Weissmuller we're talking about again there with Tarzan.
What's been the biggest recent discovery of oil?
In Canada, well, there have been some discoveries off the East Coast in places like Hibernia, off Newfoundland, but really Canada's future as an energy producer rests in the tar sands, which are...
They discovered whale oil and seal oil. Inuit did that. Great pioneers.
And we still have a large seal
hunt,
too. But the tar sands really are a questionable source of energy because it's very low quality energy. You have to use a lot of energy to produce oil from this stuff, this gooey mess, and you release a lot of carbon dioxide. So the question for Canada, I think, is really how are we going to continue the development of these resource industries? And this may be a similar situation to the one Australia faces and reduce our carbon footprint at the same time.
Which is going to be crucial. The elephant in the corner of the room we haven't talked about is China and its role in world affairs. And we can't really finish the conversation and allow it to
I think you
be
should
finished.
Make the water buffalo in the room. They don't have elephants in China.
Thank you. And the role of China, and it's certainly dominant in the resources boom that you're talking about, is completely driven by China's insatiable appetite.
Well, China could be the deal breaker for all of us when it comes to something like climate change. They're building a power plant, a coal-fired power plant every week. They've doubled their coal production in the last 5 years. They now produce 2.2 billion tons of coal a year. That's about a ton of coal, about 2 tons of coal per person in the country. And they're now the biggest carbon dioxide emitter in the world, ahead of the United States, as in the last couple of months they pulled ahead of the United States. The problem for China, of course, is that it has to maintain a growth rate of 7 to 10% a year in order to maintain internal stability and political stability and to keep the still very large number of poor peasants in the countryside reasonably happy. And it's not something they can do indefinitely because this growth is also generating huge environmental damage in the country.
This is something you've talked about in the book too, that it's only been over recent decades where we've thought that you always have to have increasing growth.
One of the arguments I make in my book, and I think it's one of the more controversial arguments, is that we have to start moving towards essentially, at least at the global level, a steady state economy where we have a static or even declining throughput of resources and energy. Now, the problem is you can't tell China to stop growing. And if China stops growing, the country will fall apart.
Yep.
So that means that some of the rest of us who are already very very rich are going to have to take a hit. And that's not a conversation we're having. It's certainly not even nationally, let alone globally.
I know you're a bit of a fan of Amory Lovins and his work, but how does that fit with his work? Because my understanding of his work was that you could improve environmental sustainability without damaging the economy.
That's right. He thinks you can have your economic growth and your clean environment and stable climate at the same time.
Have your cake and eat it too.
Have your cake and eat it too. I actually think he's wrong on this. I don't think you can, and I think he estimates he's far too optimistic in his estimates about what we can get from technological change. Now, I agree we can save probably 20 to 30% of our energy consumption through conservation and good technologies.
Maybe going nuclear, we're told. That's the big solution.
25 nuclear plants in Australia, I hear.
Well, depends who you talk to in the government at the moment and what process they're committed to, but we're certainly being asked to contemplate it for the first time.
I hope we get one in Fairfield. I'm really hanging out for it.
What's happening here is people are keeping assumptions about lifestyles constant and values constant and saying, okay, how can we develop the technologies to provide us with the stuff that we already have? What I suggest in the book is that it's actually not clear that the stuff we already have makes us terribly happy. It's not maybe the way we should be defining the good life. So maybe we should be returning to some of our deeper values and considering how we can lead perhaps simpler, less materially intensive, less consumerist lives that will put less load on the environment. And we don't have to come up with such fancy technologies.
I was reading this really distressing story the other day about a book called The Real Toy Story, and it was about toy production in China. The working conditions for the Chinese, these massive factories, these people lining up young girls, hemorrhaging, dying from overwork, being paid nothing, not being able to get the bus fare home. And you think of all those factories there making rubbish. But the amount of
capitalism.
I did a column years ago. You think of all the markets
and junk being made.
On the population of Barbie dolls, the population of Barbie dolls exceeds that of humans on the planet. That's a thought, isn't it?
And some of them are nicer people than... Oh, no, I shouldn't say that whatsoever. Philip, thank you for that. And with your contributions, we've had a wonderful opportunity to pick two brains at once. Philip Adams from Radio National's new book is Adams vs. God, The Rematch, republished after 22 years by Melbourne Uni Press. And Thomas's book, Thomas Homer Dixon's book, The Upside of Down, subtitled Catastrophe, Creativity and the Renewal of Civilization, has just been published. And they're both in town for the Melbourne Writers' Festival. And it's been wonderful to be able to have both of you here in the studio at once. This has been The Conversation Hour.